Welcome to 2 Million Blossoms, the podcast, with host Dr. Kirsten Trainer. 2 Million Blossoms is a quarterly magazine dedicated to protecting all pollinators, from the solitary bee to colorful butterflies to feisty hummingbirds and, of course, the honeybee. We bring you informative guests to awaken your understanding of the vast diversity of pollinating insects and animals worldwide. Because the more we know about pollinators, the better we can provide their habitats and protect them from disappearing forever. So sit back and listen as contributors to the magazine share in their own words and their own voices the passion they feel for all pollinators.
On today's podcast, I have the delightful pleasure of talking with biologist, pollinator conservationist, and award-winning author, Heather Holm. She's an avid contributor to iNaturalists, posts stunning photos to her Instagram account at Bees Native Plants, and has a new book out all about wasps. I'm really looking forward to learning more about wasps, as they often get a bad rap. A few select species can be a nuisance at picnics or get defensive near their nests, but many wasps are excellent hunters that help keep garden pests in check. Heather Holm lives in Minnesota, where she actively coordinates several restoration projects. Her expertise is in native plants and their pollinators. Heather, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's very exciting. I love your bee book, and I'm very excited about the new one you have coming up. I understand you've been hooked on exploring the great outdoors since childhood. You grew up exploring the prairie and the woodlands right near your family property. What was that like, and how has the landscape changed?
Boy, yeah, the landscape has changed a lot, but I think having those early childhood experiences just to be able to go out on your own and explore and experience nature and have some sort of role model that's showing you a few things to get you started. And that sort of was my childhood. I was fortunate to grow up on a property established by my great-great-grandfather. So, you know, we had the farm and we had water, lakes and prairies, as you said. So just a whole lot of exploration and learning that went on, even before I realized I was really into natural history and plants and insects.
I used to go on long nature walks with my grandmother through the heather in Germany, actually, and she'd turn it into an adventure where we were on the moon or something going through this sand landscape, and you become very aware of your surroundings and you start looking at things differently.
Yep, it's really sort of starting those observational skills at a young age that we keep for life. We may not be using those skills all the time, but once you develop them, it really changes the way you look at landscapes, plants, and everything else.
Do you have any striking memories of a particular pollinator from when you were little chasing through the prairies?
No, that's what's funny. Until I went to university, I really didn't think a whole lot about insects. And, you know, it was more about plants and, you know, the different tree species that my father would teach me how to identify all the different trees. And that really stuck with me. But insects weren't on my radar, funny enough, until I went to university.
Oh, I totally understand that. I fell into bees later in life. It wasn't until after college when I accidentally won a hive in a raffle, and then you're suddenly tending bees and all of a sudden you become aware of the plants because you want the best for your hive. And so I think they're very much a gateway into understanding how ecosystem services work. But I too am a late comer to insect and plant love, but it's highly addictive.
It is absolutely addictive. I always say once you go down the rabbit hole, you never come out.
You never quite dig yourself into the light. Or maybe I should say you're always in the light. You're sort of always hankering to be outside, exploring what's going on, what's in bloom, and what's visiting. So how did you become so interested in native plants? You mentioned you had a love of trees from an early age.
I have a funny background. I took more traditional horticulture classwork and degree. And then, you know, I worked in the landscape industry for quite a while doing the traditional things that you were taught to do. And then started doing more design work. And then I realized, you know, this just isn't really exciting. And when my husband and I moved to Minnesota approximately 18 years ago, and that's when I really started to get back into native landscapes. And the variety of landscapes here in Minnesota is amazing. You know, we have the Twin Cities area sort of is in the transition zone between broadleaf forest and prairie. So there's a lot of diversity. And so I really started designing more landscapes with native plants, starting in my own yard and then doing some professionally. And it was working in those landscapes that I really started to see the amazing insect diversity that I didn't notice working in traditional landscapes. And then over time, patterns of visitation that were really quite fascinating. And that's what inspired me to write my first book, was to, you know, highlight some of these common plant-insect interactions and to help people understand why a bee or a certain pollinator may be visiting a particular plant and what are they doing. So really diving into the details of behaviors of visitation and pollen collection and so on.
So in Minnesota, what are some of the really early bees that you end up seeing in early spring?
Oh, in early spring, we have cellophane bees, the colletes. They're early emerging ground nesters. And in sandy habitats, you'll find large nesting aggregations of that species. And so they're generally emerging to coincide with when our red maple trees bloom. And shortly after that, a lot of our willow species will start flowering. So that's generally the first species I find, although small sweat bees, Lazio glossum, are common. Some male mason bees, Osmia, you'll find on red maple and willow. And then the first species of bumblebees start, the queen start to come out. So spring is so exciting.
How large can these aggregations end up being?
Well, if they're undisturbed, you know, from year to year, those females will, the next generation will often excavate a nest right next to or even use their emergence hole. So these nesting aggregations can be quite large. There's one in a local park near my house that I have been monitoring, and it's probably 20 by 30 feet, you know, but most people don't even notice it unless they see the male emergence and that early activity of them patrolling over the ground, some people. But generally, people think they're flies. So I can get away with doing a lot of observation of these nesting aggregations without really raising eyebrows, which is nice.
And if people wanted to invite them more into their own landscapes, is just promoting a patch of sandy soil in your backyard sort of the way to go?
Trying to lure them to my yard. There's a nesting aggregation one street over in my little neighborhood, but I haven't successfully been able to do that. They are pretty, you know, tied to having a nesting site very close to the first plants, generally red maple, that particular species. So they want to set up their nesting shop as close as possible to that first food source.
So first you need to put in the stand of red maple, wait 20 years, and then maybe you'll get lucky.
Exactly. Yep. I've had some neighbors start planting red maple trees, self-serving, of course. So the one neighbor, his tree flowers quite profusely. So that's usually my first stop in spring to check out what's visiting their red maple tree.
It's always nice when you can get your neighbors to sort of help you out without them always realizing what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. He said, "Oh, so that's why you asked me to plant red maple." After I asked him if I could come over and photograph the pollinators on his tree. So
I'm sure he was happy to help out. And they are beautiful trees. I used to live in Maryland, and we have a lot of red maple. And that always sort of signified the big spring buildup for everybody. Every once in a while, it'd be really wet and it would get rained out, which was always a shame. It seems we're having wetter and wetter springs, which must make it very hard for some of these native bees to really get going.
Oh, absolutely. Last spring, that colletes, the cellophane bees started emerging the last day of March here in Minnesota. And then we had an April snowfall, when snow on the ground for, you know, 10 or 12 days. So the males were hunkered down in their emergence holes. And, you know, I really wasn't sure whether they would survive. They didn't have a food source and the females hadn't emerged yet. So whether mating would occur, the females would successfully be able to, you know, build and provision nests and lay eggs was really a big unknown. So that, I think we're going to experience more and more of that, where early spring warm up and then maybe cool, wet temperatures, or in the case here where I live, snowfall, which can really impact some of those early spring species.
Yeah, no, it's very difficult. And especially with the changing climate, the weather events seem to be more and more erratic, which must make the timing for native bees very difficult. So they get triggered by that early snap of warmth. And then if we have the rain and the cold, it can be very difficult for them to find the resources they need. I understand you work on several restoration projects in your home state. Can you transport us to these sites and sort of tell us how you're renovating them and bringing them back to what they once were?
Yeah, they're sort of my everything I do in my spare time is the local restoration projects. I have three projects in my neighborhood. My husband and I have been working on restoring a small wooded park that was very degraded when we moved to the neighborhood 18 years ago. And we've been slowly just sort of elbow grease and hand-to-hand combat removing the invasive plants from that site. And it's really becoming beautiful and diverse and now pretty much invasive plant free. So I've been working with the city. We're seeding in and creating parts of it into savanna so it'll be better pollinator habitat. And the second site is this corner lot, which I live in a neighborhood where there's one street where you can come in and out of this closed neighborhood. So everybody has to drive by this corner lot that was deemed unbuildable many years ago by the city, and it has a power line above it. And it just filled in with invasive plants. It was literally 95% invasive plants, including invasive trees. So that project I wrote a watershed grant for and recruited the neighbors. We had 32 neighbors participate in removing all the invasive plants. And pretty much since then, my husband and I have been managing that site for seeding it and planting it and, you know, yearly invasive plant removal. But it's become a little pollinator hotspot. I tend to go down there to the corner a lot more now than I spend time in my own yard, just because it's a little bit sunnier and it's in that early stage of, you know, perennial succession for prairies. So it's quite flower diverse and found some really interesting species there. So it's a fun little project.
What sort of invasives do you end up having to fight most frequently?
In Minnesota, we have two big ones. One herbaceous plant, garlic mustard, which is a biennial and just invades shady habitats and woodlands. So it tends to create a monoculture on the ground layer and suppress any native flowering plants. And then the second one is European buckthorn, which is a understory shrub or large small tree. And it just chokes out our woodlands that are sort of, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're between the broadleaf forest and prairie. So we have a lot of oak dominated woodlands here in Minnesota that are sort of the transition between a savanna and a closed canopy deciduous woods. And so this European buckthorn just loves to run into those more open deciduous oak woodlands and just fill the understory with this particular invasive species. So
I'm not familiar with buckthorn. I'm taking from the name that it probably is quite prickly and does a good job of keeping people and animals out.
It's kind of thorny, similar to like a crab apple or a wild plum, not true thorns, but like a spurs on the end of the branches. And the female, they're separate male and female plants. The females are thornier. They're really tenacious.
So once you've eliminated these invasives, what are some of the things coming in now?
We did some planting of some new tree species just to increase overall diversity. I snuck in some red maples on that site, of course. There's a pond as well. So we have this really interesting, even though it's a half acre, we have a real mix of the microhabitats, the pond edge, the sunny south-facing part, which is mostly prairie, and then the middle section, which I'm trying to restore as more of a savanna. So there's a lot of plant species that have just come back on their own and to our amazement because the site was just highly degraded. And to me, it's a great example that we think, you know, sites that are just, we think that are gone and not repairable or restorable. And that's really not the case. You can, with a lot of time and effort, you can turn these spaces around. And then I've found some very interesting wood nesting species, a couple of bees as well as wasps nesting in this big old log that we left lying on the ground in the site. So I take a stool down there and spend a lot of time just staring at the log and most of my neighbors know me, so thankfully they don't they don't think I'm crazy. But I found a wood nesting population of small sweat bees in this log, which most small sweat bees nest in the ground. So just a few species are wood nesting, and some rare solitary wasps that are nesting in this gnarly old log on the ground. So next is some signage. So my neighbors sort of understand, you know, why we're leaving these habitat components and what the purpose of they serve. Yeah.
Have you found that you get some odd looks from your neighbors, or do they start to understand and appreciate the sort of biodiversity that's coming back into their own little corner?
Yeah, most of them are appreciative. We did get one complaint because, you know, the site, we took so much biomass out of that corner lot, including trees and then the buckthorn. So one neighbor thought we were clear cutting the site, which we just failed to notify him about what we were up to. But after a good conversation with him, he seems to be on board now. Everybody appreciates the difference in the feeling that they get going to these sites now that there's been a concerted effort to restore them. Yeah.
Well, and I'm sure it's a great opportunity to also educate everybody in the neighborhood, sort of, just because they're seeing this change, they probably end up stopping and asking you questions while you're there.
Right. And the most amazing thing from the corner lot, as I said, everybody has to drive by it coming in and out of the neighborhood. So it's high visibility. And many people that helped with that project then went home and started removing the invasive plants on their own property and planting native species. So I feel like that was the best outcome of that project, and sort of unanticipated that, you know, we would be influencing a number of neighbors to become stewards of their own land.
I love these kind of ripple effects. It's sort of you throw one rock in, they see, oh, look at what happened. And then they start changing their own behaviors. And I think that's really how you get a community involved and how you start having long-lasting change.
I think so, too. And it was a sort of passive way to do it, right? A passive way to educate folks. Yeah.
That's the best. That's the way people want to learn, right? They want to learn by engaging with you instead of being force-fed information.
Better Bee is pleased to sponsor today's episode of 2 Million Blossoms, the podcast. For over 40 years, Better Bee has supplied beekeepers across the country with the tools, equipment, and knowledge needed to succeed. Because many Better Bee employees are beekeepers themselves, they understand your needs and challenges and are better prepared to answer your beekeeping questions. From their colorful catalog to their support of beekeeper educational activities, including this podcast, Better Bee truly lives up to their tagline of beekeepers serving beekeepers. See for yourself at betterbee.com.
The rusty patch bumblebee became the state bee of Minnesota in 2019. And recently, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decided not to designate critical habitat for the bees. As they say, the habitat hasn't changed that much in the last two decades when there has been the greatest decline. Why are rusty patch bumblebees endangered, and what can people do to help?
It's a complex issue, as you probably know. Yeah, and you know, I have hope that the new federal administration may change some things that will help with the protection of the species, but not designating critical habitat is really problematic. So as the listeners may know, Minnesota is sort of one of the last hotspots that this endangered species is still occurring in. Its range has contracted more than 90% of its historical range. So there's a few hotspots in Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, where people still regularly observe the rusty patch, including in the Twin Cities where I live. So not designating critical habitat means that there are no protections for the existing and documented populations in our state, even though we have it as a state bee. And the other piece is that the Fish and Wildlife Service were told by the Trump administration that they couldn't tell project proposers that they needed the permitting and habitat management plan. So we're really not doing a lot of good habitat replacement for habitat lost in any scenario, you know, especially in the urban environment where the bee is seen frequently, partly due to because of the more people looking in highly populated areas. But So I'm hoping that 2021 will change some of these things for the bee. And we have a great pollinator community in Minnesota that's keeping their eyes on the ground and monitoring the species. So that gives me a lot of hope.
Is there still a lot of urban development going on in the Twin Cities, or has most of the land already been sort of developed?
There's still a lot of development pressure, you know, just with projected populations 20 years from now. Our Metropolitan Council is telling individual municipalities you need to be able to accommodate, you know, another 5 or 10% more people. And yeah, huge growth. And for my suburb where I live, which is pretty much fully developed, puts a lot of pressure on the remaining natural areas, you know, abandoned or unbuildable lots in the case of my corner lot. The city will probably be looking at those spaces to see if they can put more single family homes as well as apartment buildings to accommodate those people that they're required to do. So there's a lot of pressure.
What can local residents who do spot a rusty patch or even just want to help in the efforts, how can they sort of get involved?
The best thing for someone to do is to report it to Bumblebee Watch or iNaturalist or both. So at least it gets mapped and researchers can look at the photos that someone takes to confirm it's the rusty patch. We have one species here in Minnesota, the brown belted, that looks similar, and people get very excited because they see the brown belted and think it's a rusty patch. But the big one is just habitat. It's now really considered an urban or suburban bee, where here in Minnesota, it's not seen as much in rural areas. So the more homeowners can start putting in pesticide-free native plantings, that should really help the bee, all types of bees, including the rusty patch.
Excellent advice. And so wasps, you've just released a new book. Unfortunately, wasps don't have the same cuddly reputation as a lot of bees. Many people wage war against them in their backyards. And there's even a meme that compares bees, describing them as cute, cuddly, fluffy, good for everyone, with a wasp, which is defined as skinny, good for nothing, basically a bee on meth, and a hornet as a wasp on steroids, usually so badass it won't even bother stinging you. I'm extremely partial to bees. I know wasps are critical too, though. Why should we be happy when we spot wasps in our garden?
They provide a number of ecosystem services. So they are, as adults, many wasps visit flowers, the flower nectar or similar sugary substances such as tree sap or honeydew is their main food source. And they are hunting insects in the landscape, often insects that cause plant damage to ornamental plants that we grow in our gardens or even food crops. So they're really critical. And what I learned researching this book and writing it is that the prey specificity of the, particularly the solitary wasps. So the makeup of wasps is similar to bees. There's a small minority are nest socially, and they are the culprits that generally are people get stung by because the nest defense mechanism. But most wasps are either parasitic or if they're nest building, they're solitary. And it's the solitary wasps that are preying on other insects, and they're very specific prey. So the prey specificity is quite narrow. Some species will only hunt one genus of insects. You know, the eastern cicada killer is a great example, just hunts cicadas. So you have all of this prey specificity and overlap of many wasps sort of living together, and collectively they're taking care of a lot of insect populations and helping them to help keeping them in balance.
I remember a wonderful example of somebody had planted milkweed and then aphids were starting to be a problem, and he usually would have grabbed for the spray can of insecticide and he decided to let it just sit, and then the parasitic wasps started showing up, and very soon the nature had taken care of its own problems. So they can be very beneficial to the home gardener for helping to eliminate some of those difficult pests.
Yeah, there's a number that, like you said, some parasitize the aphids, so then they turn into these aphid mummies. They kind of bloat up and have the wasp larva developing inside them. And then there's some very tiny wood nesting wasps that are predatory on aphids. So they'll go and capture an aphid and then take it back to their nest in a tiny hole in wood and stuff it in there and lay an egg on it. So yeah, I always tell people the same thing, like don't get out the spray bottle, take a week and observe what happens on this aphid population on your plant. And I did that a couple of years ago. I documented 8 different beneficial insects preying on the aphids, other than wasps, the ladybird beetles, the lacewing larva, some of the predatory bugs. And it was just this whole other ecosystem that was happening on the underside of one plant leaf in my garden. So,
are there some wasps that have really cool behaviors that most listeners wouldn't be aware of?
Oh, yeah. If the listeners already sort of have a good foundation of bee behavior and nesting behavior, wasps are quite similar. So many are ground nesting and the female excavates a burrow in the ground. Sometimes it's just a burrow with one cell. And the main difference between bees and wasps is wasps are provisioning their nests with insects and bees are putting pollen and nectar in their nest for their offspring. So one really interesting behavior is the wasps in the Sphecid family, the thread-waisted wasps, they use a similar vibratory mechanism that bees would use to buzz pollinate flowers. So it's that shaking of the thoracic muscles to vibrate the flower to extract pollen. And these thread-waisted wasps use this in nest excavation. So the females will clasp hold of the clumps of soil and then do that vibratory mechanism to basically jackhammer the soil to dig out their nest. And then a few species that are not ground nesting in that family, the black and yellow mud dauber wasp, they nest above ground and build these beautiful freeform mud nests. And so the females go to damp mud and use that vibratory mechanism to collect moist balls of mud, carry those clumps in their mandibles back to the nest. And then they have 2 different sonication frequencies. They use one's lower and one's higher, but for the mud collection near in moist soil, but then they also vibratory mechanism to shake that mud as they build their mud cylinders.
Oh, so fascinating. So they're like getting air bubbles out and really making it super strong.
Yep. So there's so many similarities between bees and wasps that I try and highlight in the book to give people a sense that they really are. Some of them are ancestors of bees, of course, and these similarities in nesting behaviors and the sonication to me was really fascinating.
I assume they come in a large range of sizes and colors as well. So
absolutely.
What are the smallest wasps in North America?
Oh, they're probably some of the parasitic wasps. For the book, they're just so diverse and they're well documented, but very difficult to identify. So I decided that I would feature the sort of larger, easier to observe, more predatory wasps for the book rather than those super tiny braconid or ichneumon wasps that can be quite very, very small. You know, they'll be laying their eggs in other insects. Sometimes you'll find them braconid wasps perched on a flower head, and then they typically have a pretty long ovipositor that they're shoving down into the substrate, whether it's nesting substrate or a flower, to inject their egg into another insect larva or adult. So lots of cloak and dagger stuff going on.
And do you have one wasp that you admire for its habits or coloration that you want to tell us about?
Oh, I think one of the most charismatic wasps that people see frequently in their garden is the great golden digger wasp. And it's in that thread-waisted wasp family. And they're just beautiful. They have sort of very short gold hairs on their head and thorax, and then bright orange abdomen. And they, you know, we talk about the monarch chrysalis being so beautiful with the gold ornaments, the dots on the chrysalis. Well, this wasp, I think, is much more beautiful and interesting to look at. And, you know, we just have to get beyond this idea that all wasps are going to sting people. It's like watching bee observation in the garden. If they're, I always say, if they're they're at the flower restaurant and not near the house. You know, they have no interest in stinging you.
Well, and the headlines for the murder hornet and everything obviously don't help, so.
No, thankfully that's a Western species, Western established population, or maybe my book focuses on Eastern North America. I do have the European hornet, which has been present in the U.S. for quite some time, and it's not as large as the murder hornet, but can invade honeybee hives similarly.
I've run into that one on two occasions, and my immune system does not react well, unfortunately. So the European hornet and I are on cautious terms with one another.
I'm sure, especially if you're managing hives, yep.
So you also host pollinator walks when we're not in COVID lockdown, where participants can catch and then gently release insects. What do you typically spot on such walks, and any unexpected surprises that you've experienced?
Yeah, it's really, you know, variable. So if the organization or whoever wants to have a pollinator walk, if they've chosen the site, usually I try and vet the site to make sure, well, if we have a group of people, we'll see enough, you know, diversity or variety of flower visiting insects. We did find a rusty patch bumblebee at a conservation property that my friend manages. So that was an exciting find. I've done pollinator walks for all types of people and age groups. Girl Scouts, for example, the younger kids just absolutely love being the ones that can go out and capture an insect in a container. I always have to remind them, though, I always kind of cringe, you know, worrying that they're going to screw that lid on and a leg or a wing is stuck in the lid. But generally, all pollinators go free of injury. But it's a really nice way. I have these just simple, very clear plastic containers, show people that it's okay to approach insects on flowers, just have the container upside down and place it over a bee or other flower visiting insect, and then slide the lid underneath. And then we can pass it around and people get a chance to see. I've done bumblebee specific walks, for example. So it's an opportunity to show the different coloration patterns and how I came to the conclusion of, you know, what species it is. I'll often combine that with some handouts to show people what we're looking at and what you're looking for. So it's really a non-threatening way to introduce people to pollinator observation. And then I get to slip in all these fun natural history tidbits to get them to understand habitat more for that particular species.
I know when I've been in science centers and displaying observation hives, it's often the children who come running up all excited and the parents are like, oh no, it stings, let's stay back. It's a wonderful sort of reversal of fear and excitement. And I think when you get the youngest generation very excited about what is happening in their own neighborhoods, it gives them a whole different appreciation for the world around them.
So. Yeah, it's a really nice way to teach observation skills. And you said it exactly. It's usually the parents that are starting to sort of step back and a little bit wary of, you know, being the one that has to go and capture an insect from a flower. But the kids are gung-ho and they're running up to flowers and running back to their parents with the container filled with something. And so I think it's another nice passive way to show folks that this is something you can do on your own with your children and teach them how to observe. Or the children are teaching the parents.
Yeah, and I think this early introduction to sort of science and observation is so critical. And even if you end up in a completely different field, the skills of observation will serve you well no matter what you do.
Yep, I agree. I think more folks need to work on that skill that they have, but they just haven't practiced much lately.
Yeah. Well, I think the one good thing with COVID is it has forced everybody to appreciate their own backyard more.
Absolutely. And local parks. Yeah. 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 More and more use of the local parks. So that idea that we can replenish our, you know, or get rid of our stress immersing ourselves in nature. I think our lives were so busy before COVID that many people maybe forgot about that value of just sort of getting rid of that stress and
getting away from our devices and getting a little bit of fresh air and extra sunshine.
Yeah. So. Yep.
If you had to pick one pollinator plant to add into a home garden, what would it be?
Oh boy, tough question. Just one. Well, I always stress to folks that early spring and late fall, people often forget about those sort of bookend times during the growing season that we tend to not have enough blooming in our gardens for pollinators. So for early spring, I would maybe pick willow if there's a willow species that's appropriate for a home garden, or if you have larger property, you have more options. But that's a really amazing plant for pollinators, and separate male-female plants, but especially in the central and eastern U.S., it supports a number of pollen-collecting specialist bees and very good at for larval host plants for butterflies and moths. So it's a real what we call a keystone or powerhouse plant.
Oh, nice. And then on the ottoman, the other bookend?
Oh, the ottoman is easy. Goldenrod. Just, I tell folks, have at least three species of goldenrod growing in your garden, because we have this wonderful variety, no matter where you live, that you can really have a continuous succession from mid-August all the way into late October, November, of different goldenrod species. And that's a highly nutritious plant for especially those fall solitary bees that need that pollen to provision their nests.
And is there a good species you recommend for the home garden in Minnesota?
Oh, in Minnesota, we have a number of options, and it really depends on what kind of soil you have. So drier, sandy habitat, gray goldenrod is Solidago nemoralis is nice. Stiff goldenrod is a nice sort of well-behaved goldenrod, upright, clump-forming. And then we have some nice shade species. Zigzag goldenrod, for example, is a beautiful plant that you can grow in part or full shade that helps light up your woodland garden in the fall.
Yeah, and I'm always amazed at the diversity of pollinators that will be on the same goldenrod plant. I think I've seen up to 8 species at one time on the same plant.
Yep. And you'll find plenty of wasps too on goldenrod, so I have to put in a plug for them.
Are they after the nectar at that time, or are they hunting for prey?
A bit of both. Many are just nectar feeding, yeah.
I've definitely seen them right next to the honeybees, and they seem to ignore one another. So
yeah, the male paper wasps in the fall can get a little, what I call, ornery or territorial on the goldenrod flowers. Their antics, they like to take runs at other insects to drive them off the flower, but it's all just gesture. And as you know, like bees, male wasps don't have a sting. So,
well, is there anything else you'd like to add that I didn't ask you that you want to leave as an end note to our listeners?
No, I can't think of anything. I really enjoyed speaking with you, Kirsten. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, and enjoy 2021. I hope it starts to resemble normalcy as we progress through spring and summer.
Me too. Yep, and I can't wait for spring. So thank you.